to extend, though, Gaz continued.
"Scotland Yard are up here again," he said. "I had the word from my sergeant this afternoon. It's the Druitt suicide. You know about it, Trev?"
A very odd question, Trevor thought. That Gaz hadn't been summarily sacked as a result of Druitt's death was owing entirely to Clover's intercession on behalf of the young man who'd quickly become her protégé while he was in training. Gaz surely knew that Clover would have told her husband about all of it. He said, "I'm not likely to be in the dark about that, Gaz."
"Oh, I didn't mean the, you know, the death. I meant, did you know Scotland Yard are coming a second time? Did Clo tell you? I'm only wondering why she didn't ring me, see? I'd think she would do. She has to know about this, eh?"
"Haven't the least idea. I've not seen her. I can have her ring you when she gets home."
"I'd be that grateful. It's only just that—"
"It's only that you're worried. I know, it's reasonable.
Rumour is there might be a lawsuit."
"Try not to think so far ahead. One day at a time. Clover's asked me to phone you about having dinner with us, by the way." They made their arrangements for the dinner, and his duty done, Trevor set to rummaging through the fridge. He was the family cook, had been since the day of his marriage to a cop with a hellish schedule, and he sought whatever he could come up with for a decent stir-fry. He was sniffing a package of tofu and asking himself if tofu could go bad when his mobile rang. He saw it was Clover, and he answered with, "I expected you home long before now, Mrs. Freeman. I was hoping for a little bit of this and a bigger bit of that. Can I interest you?" She answered him with, "Have you managed to reach Gaz? Why haven't you returned my calls?"
"What's all this with Gaz, Clover? He's in a twist about Scotland Yard planning another trip to Shropshire, by the way."
"They're not planning.
They're here," was her reply. "Wyatt's in a complete state about it. Well, who can blame him? What a bucket of horse shit this is."
Then she sighed and went on with, "Never mind. I'm in a mood. I'll be home soon. Shall I stop for takeaway, or have you done the shop?" Takeaway would save him, but he knew she was probably knackered and would prefer just to drive straight home. "No need," he said. "I'll manage something." Although the truth was that he'd also had a look at the celery, which had turned out to be as limp as a eunuch's dick. The red and green peppers were much better, and an onion was in the midst of turning an unappealing shade of purplish-grey.
"I'm concocting a healthy dinner to impress you. I'm concocting other things as well."
"Are you? We'll see about that. I've had one hell of a day."
When they rang off, Trevor started the brown rice. A lot of it, as the rest of the meal was going to need some serious help. Once he'd done that, he went for wine. Considering Clover's state, she would want a very large glass of it. From the cupboard beneath the stairs, he unearthed a bottle of Tempranillo. He uncorked it and decided it could breathe well enough in two large, bold glasses. He poured them and reckoned his own didn't need to breathe at all. He drank as he chopped all of the usable veg they had. He had bought himself an electric wok some time in the past, but so far he hadn't gone to the bother of learning how to use it. So a large pan was going to have to suit, and he sorted this out and doused its bottom with cooking oil. He was just about to peel the garlic when he heard a car door slam outside the house. He grabbed Clover's wine, made fast tracks for the front door, and opened it. She was done up in that no-nonsense fashion she employed for workdays, hair a severe bun, low on her neck, uniform uncreased even late in the day, stud earrings of gold and no other jewellery save her engagement and wedding rings. She did indeed look knackered, but as ever, she looked perfectly delicious to him. He saw that she was examining his hiking sticks and boots, as he'd intended. She raised her gaze from them to him. He extended the wine glass to her, and as she took it, she said,
"How far, then?"
When he said he'd done 12 miles, she hooted and returned with,
"When pigs fly."
But still she kissed him there on the doorstep. She made the kiss last, and he did nothing to end it. She said against his mouth,
"Please feel me up properly. The neighbours would probably like a diversion."
He was very happy to cooperate. Despite the day she'd had, there appeared to be hope for what would follow. She said,
"You know, you're still the most delicious thing on two legs."
And then she added with a laugh as her hand explored his crotch,
Seems like three legs."
Trevor decided that sex as a prelude to dinner and conversation could be the answer. After an interlude in the bedroom or the sitting room, or right there in the entry, Clover might be able to relax. But before he could engage in a move other than circling the tips of his fingers round her left nipple, she stirred in his arms and said,
"Is something burning?"
God, he'd completely forgotten. He released Clover and said, "Fuck." Then, "Got to go to the rescue. Won't be long till dinner. Sorry. About the, you know, the third leg and all."
"Just as well. I'm done in."
"Perhaps later?"
"We'll see.
Best take care of... She sniffed the air.
Would that be right?
You're very good, he told her. He dashed to the kitchen, where he discovered that while the bottom of the rice pan held a real blackened skin of the stuff, the rest was edible. So while Clover was, one hoped, up in the bedroom, slipping into something seductive, comfortable, and suitable for quick removal, he saw to the rest of their meal. He finished browning the tofu when Clover returned to him, wine glass in her hand. She topped up her Tempranillo and held the bottle out to him with a questioning look, but he shook his head. The glass and a half he'd downed had produced enough of a pleasant buzz. She sat at the table. He could see she was restless, rearranging cutlery, folding paper napkins, realigning plates. It wasn't like her to be so fidgety. He said, "How bad is it?
This Scotland Yard business? I'm not drunk enough yet."
She took up her wine glass, but merely examined the garnet colour of the Spanish wine. She said, shrewdly,
"Did you really walk 12 miles?
He knew he looked abashed, as he replied, "No."
"One mark for honesty. Where did you go? Down the pub?"
"I was with the Rambling Rogues, all right. But there was a shorter option today."
"Of?"
He chose this moment to attend to the browning tofu. When she said his name in that way she had, that declared, "You'll be in trouble if you don't answer," he said, "3 miles," and glanced in her direction. She was casting her own gaze heavenward.
"Oh, for God's sake, Trev! You're in a bloody fitness centre. If you can't find the time for a decent workout—"
"I know," he cut in, "and I intend to. Don't make your day worse by worrying about me. I'm fit. I'm giving up chips and beer."
"As before, with the pigs and their wings."
They bantered with each other as he finished up with their dinner. It didn't take long till he carried the meal to the table, which sat in a small alcove that looked out at the back garden. In the month of May, their lawn at least should have been thick and lush, but it seemed that they never had the time to deal with it properly. The sole attempt at making something special out of the entire space had been to throw 14 different packets of seeds on the ground and hope for the best. That hadn't turned out half bad, since they did have flowers here and there, those that survived through some sort of Darwinian process. He said to her, "As to Scotland Yard?"
"Still not drunk enough. Tell me about your day."
There wasn't much to tell when one ran a fitness centre. Spinning classes, hot yoga, swimming, Zumba, weight training. These didn't offer intriguing topics of conversation, unless an old codger took on too much activity and an ambulance needed to be called. Occasionally one of the trainers ran afoul of propriety and had to be dealt with. Hands off the lovely young mothers attempting to get back into condition, please. But that was it. He said, "Very little to report. Went out with the rogues, saw many trees, frightened half a dozen deer, observed rabbits, counted magpies. Aside from doing the wages at the centre and chatting to Gaz, that was it. I do think he wants you to ring and give him reassurance about Scotland Yard turning up again." She was, he saw, not digging into her food. She'd removed her hair from the severity of its bun, and she ran her hand through it, back from her forehead. She said,
"I expect he does. But I don't know how much more I can do for him, Trev.
The real issue is going to be Finnegan, anyway." Trevor frowned. He saw that she clocked his expression, because she went on to say,
"They're probably going to speak to him again. The Met."
"Ah. Well, Druitt and Finn were mates, after all."
"But they weren't. Not really. Ian Druitt was someone Finnegan thought he knew. And nothing anyone can say to him has been enough to convince him he didn't actually know Druitt at all."
"Anyone?"
"What?"
"You said nothing anyone can say. But I expect you mean nothing you could say."
"I do tend to know more about the darker side of mankind than Finnegan does."
"I wouldn't disagree with that.
On the other hand, the boy was rather involved in that club.
He wasn't just going through the motions. He had a real interest for once, so he would have seen things from the inside, wouldn't he?"
"I think it's rather that he would have seen exactly what he was intended to see. This passion he has about Druitt's innocence in all matters. It's quite mad, Trev. God, I wish he'd never met the man."
Trevor had gone back to his food, but now he looked up from it. He said nothing, but he didn't need to. She read him well, as she always had done.
"Yes, yes, I know," she said. "I was the one who wanted him involved in a social program. I was the one who made it a condition of this college experience he was so desperate to have. I was the one who approved his choice of the after-school club as the social program. I see, I see. I see it all. But he was meant merely to volunteer in an activity in Ludlow. That was it. Full stop. He wasn't meant to make it a life interest."
"He's hardly done that," Trevor pointed out.
"Oh, I don't know.
It's all gone straight to hell. My intention was just to keep him occupied, so when he had free time he'd have something other than, I don't know, drinking, drugs, sexual profligacy, whatever, to tempt him. And look how it's all come out. Every which way it's a mess, when all along the only thing I want is to get him through life without his ending up in jail.
Trevor deliberately made no reply to this, because he wanted her to hear her own words. From them he wanted her to understand for once what she was declaring about their son. It was no lie that Finnegan had been a challenge straight out of the womb, but he was not a criminal type, nor had he ever been. A bit wild, yes. Rather more ungovernable, yes. Sometimes defiant, but never with any intention of doing wrong. After a moment of silence, she said in a completely altered tone,
"All right. I see what you want me to see. This isn't about Finnegan, it probably never was. And I admit I'm out of sorts. It's the pressure, Trev. If the work of the West Mercia police force is under scrutiny, it means we're all under scrutiny, and Gaz Ruddock's work in particular is under scrutiny. Again, I suppose my concern is that Finnegan not make things worse with wild declarations about Druitt that cause everything to turn out badly."
"For who?" Trevor found himself asking this question with some care, because there seemed to be waters here that he'd not known existed before this conversation.
She said, "For Gaz, I suppose. This is essentially the fourth time he's been looked at. He might be sacked."
"He might well be. But that would be down to him, wouldn't it?"
"Well, it's hardly fair to ask him to go through this yet another time."
"Is it a question of fairness?" Trevor reached for his wine glass but didn't drink until he'd said,
"To be honest, Clover, I'd no idea that what happens to Gaz Ruddock worries you." "Of course it worries me. Why wouldn't it worry me? I took him on, Trevor. I told myself I saw something in him that warranted my interest, and I made him special, my personal project, my protégé. And he's done splendidly until this Druitt thing. He's never put a foot wrong, so I don't want him to lose his job. And beyond that..."
Trevor could tell she was hesitating because she'd either just realized something, or because she was venturing near to something she didn't want him to know. He said, "What?" Still, nothing. She looked at her wine glass. She turned its stem in her fingers. She drank. "Clover?" "What?"
"It's this. If he looks bad, then I look bad. I don't want that, and I expect in my position you wouldn't want it either."
"And that's all, is it?"
"What else would it be?"
Trevor said after a moment of hesitation, "I suppose that's the real question." He knew his next remark was iffy. He recognized that it was going to stir up those waters that he'd only just realized might be there. But he needed to take a step closer to those waters, so he said, "I've not thought of this before, but what's Gaz Ruddock actually to you, Clover?" She stared at him for what seemed like a minute, but was probably not. She finally responded with,
"What on earth are you asking me?"
"Nothing more than the words I spoke. What's Gaz Ruddock to you?
Is he something more than someone whose cause you took up because you told yourself you saw something in him? I believe I've already explained myself. Have you?
Completely, I mean."
"What exactly are you implying?"
"I'm just asking you a question. It seems you're in a state about Gaz Ruddock, so it's logical for me to ask about him, isn't it?"
"Is it?" she asked. "We see things differently."
She placed her napkin on the table, crossed her cutlery on the plate.
"I think we're finished here," she told him.
"The Scotland Yard officers are arriving soon. You might want to explore your concerns with them." Worcester, Herefordshire. The DCC lived in a newish housing estate where detached brick houses had both garages and driveways, and front gardens grew lawns that were bordered with colourful flower beds. The Freeman home was identical to the others, but in possession only of a sad-looking lawn. Upon ringing the bell, they were admitted into the house not by the DCC, but by a man who introduced himself as Trevor Freeman, the DCC's husband. He was a sharp-featured bloke with a shaved skull where the shadow of stubble indicated a deeply receding hairline. He was tall, just an inch shorter than Linley, but he carried too much weight round his middle, like a lot of men his age, which appeared to be somewhere in his late 40s or early 50s. That, Linley thought, probably eliminated Clover Freeman as Gran. So if there was a relationship between her and one Finnegan Freeman, it would probably be mother or aunt. Clover, Trevor Freeman told them, was just putting together a tray of coffees. If they'd take a seat in the lounge, she'd be with them directly. He indicated an open doorway to their right, where a fireplace held unlit, artificial coals, and where on the wall a very large flat-screen television with a sound muted was broadcasting With Nail and I. They entered, and Trevor Freeman followed. They saw at once that one of the walls had been dedicated to family photos. The couple apparently had only one child, as pictures of a boy throughout the years were arranged, as artfully as these things can be, round a large wedding picture of the late 20-something Freemans, Trevor with fine-looking curly hair and his wife appearing suitably radiant. Unexpectedly, the photo brought to Linley's mind his own wedding day and Helen, and, fleetingly, how it had felt the moment they were made husband and wife. That stab through the heart that was his being's way of saying yes to something he had not recognized till he'd nearly lost her to someone else, and then he'd lost her anyway. But that did not bear thinking about. Havers was saying, "This is your boy, eh?" Trevor Freeman was replying with, "Yes, right, that's Finn, that is."
"He's nice looking," Havers noted.
"He was that. Then he shaved off half his hair and had his skull tattooed. I can't say it did much for the overall look of him."
"Ouch," Havers said. "But at least he can cover it when he grows the hair back. Presumably."
He rubbed his own bald head, saying, "As long as he doesn't inherit this." Havers looked among the other photos, saying,
"He's your only one.
We wanted more, but it didn't happen. Might still, of course."
"How old's he, then?"
"Just 19. He lives in Ludlow. He's at the college."
"We're hoping he finds something useful to do with his life while he's there. I'm Clover Freeman."
They swung round from the pictures. The deputy chief constable stood in the doorway bearing a tray that held a large coffee press, as well as mugs and the rest of the paraphernalia of coffee drinking. Her husband quickly took this from her, which allowed her to offer her hand first to Linley and then to Havers. Each of them introduced themselves. She suggested they sit, and she poured them each a cup of coffee, along with one for herself. There was no fourth mug, and she clarified why when she said to her husband,
"Trev, if you've something else to do, there's no need for you to be here, I expect."
And she turned for verification to Linley, adding,
"Is there, Inspector?"
Trevor said, "You've not come about Finn, have you?" As if their answer was going to dictate whatever he did next. Linley said pleasantly, "Not that I know. Should we have done?" Clover said,
"I can't see why."
"Then I'll leave you lot to it," was Trevor Freeman's conclusion. And he did just that. A moment later they could hear him climbing the stairs. A moment after that a television program blared, but its volume was immediately lowered. All of this gave Linley the time to study Clover Freeman, now that it had been established that she was the mother of the Finnegan whom Havers had referenced and whom Isabel had interviewed. She wasn't tall, but she was in admirable physical condition, as evidenced by the singlet-style top she wore, which showed the firm arms and developed shoulders of someone who trained with weights. Her cropped leggings completed the picture of her fitness. She was muscle and sinew without a hint of flab anywhere. Once they'd all seen to their coffees, she said to them,
"How can I help you? Chief Constable Wyatt told me you'd be coming to headquarters. I'm sorry I couldn't be there when you spoke with him earlier."
Linley nodded at Havers to give her the lead. She said,
"Our guff, DCS Ardrey. She took your Finnegan through the paces the first time we were here. He never once said his mum's a cop. He also never said his mum was the one who gave the order to pick up his pal Ian Druitt."
Chloe Freeman looked from Havers to Linley and back to Havers. She said,
"Am I meant to comment on that?"
Linley said, "We're trying to clarify all the relationships we're coming across."
"There certainly can't be many." "This one," Havers pointed out, "you, your son, Ian Druitt, Geraldine Gunderson, and I suppose we ought to add Gary Ruddock. It's the one that's got us wondering the most."
"Why?" Havers shrugged.
"It's a case of turning over a rock in Ian Druitt's death and discovering another relationship lying in wait."
The DCC picked up a spoon and stirred her coffee. She said,
"I see. Well, I have one actual relationship here with my son. He had a relationship with Mr. Druitt. I never met the man. Everything else is either chain of command or what led up to Mr. Druitt's suicide."
Linley saw that a Q&A about relationships could quickly become merely a disagreement about how three individual police officers saw things relative to Ian Druitt's death. He said, "We're back in Shropshire because Sergeant Havers discovered there was a stretch of 19 days between an anonymous call and the death of Ian Druitt. But the IPCC's report makes no mention of that, or of what went on during those 19 days. We know from our conversation today with your CC that there was no inquiry made into the paedophilia allegations during that time gap. Since you were the one who brought the 19 days to an end, we're hoping you can tell us why." She'd been listening carefully, her gaze fixed on Lindley as he spoke. She replied with, "That's quite simple to explain. I knew nothing about an anonymous call prior to that day."
"How'd you learn about it, then?"
Havers had taken out her notebook, Lindley saw, so apparently her DCC Freeman, and her expression was not one that welcomed the fact. Freeman frowned and said after a moment,
"I got the word at the training centre, as I recall. We had quite a large meeting there. It's on the headquarters grounds. And at some point word started going round. A deacon of the church, paedophilia."
"Do you recall how you yourself heard the word?" Lindley asked.
"I'm very sorry. There was a great deal going on that day. What I can tell you for certain is that I became aware that a number of individuals were talking about an allegation against this man, Ian Druitt. I wish I could be more specific than that."
"Why do you have Druitt fetched in for questioning, then?"
Havers asked.
"Is it typical when a tip is rung in?
I mean, it's obvious that a tip having to do with an ongoing investigation would be passed along straight away to the officers in charge, but this wasn't about an ongoing case at all, far as I've been able to suss out."
"That's true," Freeman said. "But this was a tip about a possible paedophile that had been ignored, and I didn't like that, either as a deputy chief constable or as a mother."
"So you rang Gunderson and told her to haul him in?"
"That would be the short version. I ordered her to see to it that someone brought him in."
"How long was this after you heard about the accusation?" Lindley asked.
"As I've said, I rang her that same evening and told her to have someone fetch the man to the station, and that's what she did. But you must have paperwork from the Met's earlier visit that explains all this."
"If you'll refresh our memories," Lindley said politely. Freeman's expression altered. It was one of those momentary things, muscles tightening quickly round the eyes, something one might miss altogether if one were not watching for every reaction. This particular reaction told Lindley that the DCC fully understood that neither his mind nor Havers's mind needed refreshing, that he was only asking her to go over old material in order to rattle her.
"For example," he said, "why didn't you just ring the Shrewsbury station and tell them to handle it?"
"I did too," she replied, "but there was no one available, as they had a situation going on, so I rang Jerry Gunderson. She's in charge of the PCSOs in that area. I asked her to have the Ludlow PCSO do the job."
"Why the rush?" Lindley asked. "If the Shrewsbury officers were busy, surely this was something that could have waited till they were available."
"Indeed it could have done," she admitted. "I'm at fault for what happened. Finnegan, you see,"
and here she nodded at the wall of photos,
"worked with Mr. Druitt. If there was the slightest chance of anything—"
She picked up her mug and cradled it between her hands. She looked as uncomfortable as she no doubt felt when she went on, saying,
"I wanted Finnegan away from Druitt if there was the slightest chance that any part of this paedophilia allegation was true, so I wanted Mr. Druitt questioned thoroughly."
She took a sip from her mug and set it back on the coffee table. She said frankly,
"I overreacted, Inspector. Druitt, Finnegan, paedophilia, a children's club. A tip that Druitt was messing children about. I wanted to know what the actual situation was because of my son."
She tilted her head in the direction her husband had taken and added,
"Trev would be only too happy to tell you that this wasn't the first time my focus was on Finnegan, only this time it ended terribly."
Havers said, "Gary Raddocks told me he left Mr. Druitt on his own in the Ludlow station because he was dealing with other events in town."
"He's not telling you he left the station, is he?"
"Sorry, no. Just that he left Mr. Druitt by himself."
"That's what I understand happened,"
the DCC concurred.
"I was told it was a binge-drinking matter. But I assume you know this already. I can't imagine you didn't learn it the first time you were here."
"It's the 19-day gap that brought us back here," Lindley reminded her. Havers added,
"Well, that and Clive Druitt, the dead bloke's dad. No one wants the publicity that'll go with a lawsuit if he files one."
"I'm desperately sorry about it all," Freeman said. "The ultimate responsibility for when it occurred is mine. I know that. Believe me, if I could turn back time..."
"Like the song says," Havers agreed.
Ludlow, Shropshire. Barbara Havers knew she had to work, not to loathe Clover Freeman. The DCC had more than 10 years on her, but she looked like a bloody Olympian. Barbara's inclination was to find her either deeply suspicious or downright guilty of something, although the truth was that the only real thing she appeared to be guilty of was seeing to her health and well-being through working out on the athletic equipment that Barbara had espied within a conservatory that opened off the Freeman sitting room. Bloody woman was probably a sodding vegetarian as well, Barbara thought. She made no mention of this as she and the inspector headed back to Shropshire, wending their way to Griffith Hall, which once again would be her lodgings. Instead, she dwelt on one aspect only of what they'd been told by the DCC, and that was her admission of being an overprotective mother. The way she saw it, Barbara explained to Linley, Clover Freeman's overprotecting her son could mean one of two things in a situation of alleged paedophilia. Either the DCC was attempting to run interference in case there was truth to the allegation, and she hadn't wanted Finnegan hanging round the bloke, or she was worried Finnegan himself might be involved in some way. "He watches Druitt for a while and decides to join in for a round or two of grope and poke," was how she put it. When Linley gave her one of his dry glances, she said quickly, "Sorry," and then after a moment to think more about it, "Or he's the one messing the little ones about. He gets caught at it and he has to do something, so he makes the call accusing Druitt. He doesn't live far from the Ludlow station, as it turns out." After a few minutes of silent and, she presumed, meditative driving on Linley's part, he said, "I see those are possibilities, as unpleasant as they sound." Then they were silent again. It was now growing dark. North of London as they were, despite the distance not being overly great, the days were longer. Not many structures, less to block the sun, she reckoned. More open land and rolling hills, the panoramas broken by coppices planted long ago. Finally, Linley said, "This issue of paedophilia, Barbara..." And he paused. He looked reflective, and she wondered why, till he went on with, "I knew someone from Eton who was so inclined."
"A teacher?"
"No, an old Etonian. He claimed he'd never acted upon it, but he had photos. They were hidden, but in the course of an investigation I came across them." He glanced at her, and she was surprised to see that for the first time in her memory of him, the inspector looked not only uncomfortable, but also troubled. She said,
"Christ, John Corntell! You cavered for him! Did you never think... he could be out there right now. Like, this very moment. Like, doing what he only was looking at before. Jesus on the cross, sir!"
"I know," he said. "I'm not proud of what I did. He keeps in touch with me. He says he's clear of it. But the truth is, God only knows."
"So what is this?" she asked. "Confession time? Might have come sooner, considering all the rubbish you're holding on me."
"It's given me some sleepless nights, Barbara. I'm fully aware of how much I might be responsible for. Among other things I'm responsible for." She knew what that last bit meant. Helen's death. He should have borne nothing at all on his shoulders for what had happened to his wife, but he refused to see that. Yet Barbara didn't go there in conversation, considering what he'd just told her. What he'd done was an abrogation of responsibility so profound on his part that it left her reeling. It also left her seeing him more fully as a human being, which she had to admit was how he had always seen her. They were negotiating Leominster before he spoke again, seeking a route to the A49 which would take them up to Ludlow. "What all of that brought to my mind was the idea of photographs. Was there anything among Druitt's belongings that suggested paedophilia to you?"
"Photos of naked little kids. Child porn. Nothing like that, if you're talking about actual photos and the like, but isn't that generally done with the internet anyway?"
"That's where the trails are, yes. Did Ian Druitt possess a computer, a laptop, a tablet?"
"We never came across one," Barbara told him. "Considering that he wouldn't have been rolling in dosh, that's not too strange, is it?"
"What about Clive Druitt?"
"Do you mean did he hand one over? If that's what you're asking, the answer is no. Of course, he could have just kept one he came across, couldn't he? He might have needed one, except he's probably not hurting for it, so why wouldn't he just buy one? Why keep his son's?"
"If there was something on it," Linley pointed out.
"He would have had to check, and that means he would have had to know he ought to be looking for something. That doesn't seem likely, you ask me."
"The woman he lived with, his landlady, what was her name?"
"Flora Bevans. I suppose she could have kept a laptop or a tablet, although I don't know if she would have handed it over to Druitt, as she'd need it herself."
"He could have done his searches on his mobile," Linley said.
"Except..."
"Good God, are you telling me there wasn't even a mobile?" Linley looked over at her. He'd made the turn onto the A49, and now they were on a straight path to Ludlow. he went on with, "That doesn't make sense. He didn't live at the vicarage. The vicar would need a way to contact him. Even if he had a landline where he lived, how convenient would that be? He'd have to keep dashing home to pick up messages, or someone would have to keep taking them for him. I can't see it. There must be a mobile somewhere. We need to find it." Barbara saw the logic in this and was embarrassed that in going through Ian Druitt's belongings, it hadn't occurred to her to ask a single question about the technology the deacon might have used. She said, "I reckon Mr. Spencer's the one to ask first, Inspector, the vicar. He doesn't have an oar in this race, if you know what I mean. I expect he'll tell us the truth straight away. Computer, laptop, tablet, mobile, and what you will. We'll speak to him tomorrow morning, then." It was late when they finally reached Griffith Hall. Linley manoeuvred his treasured motor through the narrow gate to the car park and found a place for it, suitably distant from any other vehicle as well as from the random passer-by who might lay a finger upon it. They collected their belongings, and in very short order Peace on Earth was welcoming Barbara back to Ludlow and introducing himself and his ear gauges to D.I. Linley.
"I've put you back in your original rooms," he told them helpfully. He said to Barbara, "I can show you the way if you don't remember, or if you need help with the bags."
Barbara wanted to say it wasn't likely she would forget either the way to or the luxury offered by her room. She said to Peace,
"I expect we can manage. Follow me, Inspector," and she went for the stairs.
When they reached her room first, as they'd done before, Linley politely swung the door open. He said, "Ah," before he placed his own bag on the floor. She said,
"Oh, Inspector, this one's mine. You're meant to take the other."
He said, "I can cope, Sergeant. It's only a place to sleep."
"Are you sure? I mean, DCS Ardrey had a different room, a bigger one. This one, to be honest, I think she more or less wanted me to suffer."
"When the Met is paying, we all suffer, Sergeant. Shall I help you with your belongings?"
"I can manage," she told him. "You'd never find your way back once we get there. It's all corridors, stairs and fire doors from this point on. But are you sure you don't want the room that DCS Ardrey was given?"
"How different could they possibly be?" he asked.
"Well, there is that," she said.
17th May. Ludlow, Shropshire. As soon as Barbara saw D.I. Linley wince as he politely rose from the breakfast table, she knew that she should have insisted. On the previous night she'd taken a quick tour of the suite. She didn't know what else to call it, that Ardrey had been given on their earlier stay, and sheer guilt had compelled her to retrace her route to Linley's room directly, her bag in her grasp. Of course she wanted the Ardrey room. It wasn't likely she'd ever be able to afford to stay in those kinds of digs with her own money any time soon, but she knew that she didn't belong there. Linley had answered the door with his toothbrush in hand. It held a quite thick, linear glob of toothpaste. His dentist, she thought, would have been proud. He blinked and said, "Sergeant, something wrong?" She replied with,
"We have to switch rooms, Inspector."
"Must we? Why?"
"You'll know when you see it. You haven't unpacked, have you? I mean, aside from the toothpaste. And I suppose the dental floss, if you're a good boy, and I reckon you are when it comes to your oral hygiene. I'm delighted you've noticed." "Right. Anyway, collect your clobber and I'll show you the way."
She plopped her own bag on the floor and shoved it into his room with her foot. He said, "Again? Why?"
"Why do we have to switch rooms? Because the other's more grand. It's more suited to your worshipfulness, or whatever."
"Don't be absurd, Sergeant," was his reaction. "We're both of us using the rooms for sleeping. We're not here for anything else. At least I'm not. And if you are, perhaps meeting up with some dashing devil in tap shoes that I've not learned about from D. Harriman, then you're best to remain where you are. I shall see you in the morning." She reckoned he'd regret it. And when she saw the wince, she knew she'd been right. But he refused to speak of how he slept, or didn't sleep, and once they were finished with their breakfast, they got on to the vicar. They found him just coming out of St. Lawrence Church, perhaps in the aftermath of a morning service, as he was in the company of several elderly women carrying similarly shaped and bound books in their hands. Rather a depressingly small congregation, but as it was midweek, perhaps that was the reason, Barbara thought. As Christopher Spencer bade the women farewell, he caught sight of Barbara and Linby. He walked to join them just the other side of the wrought-iron fence that marked the grounds of the church.
"Sergeant Havers," he said in a friendly fashion, "are you still in town, or have you returned?"
Barbara was pleased he remembered her name. although since he was probably charged with recalling the identities of his parishioners, she expected he'd long ago come up with a way to keep people's names in his head. She said, "Returned," and she introduced him to Linley. Then she said, "We're hoping to have a word with you if you have time."
"Of course. Would you like to come to the vicarage with me? I can't offer you anything save coffee, although I can probably dig up a digestive of dubious freshness."
Barbara demurred, as did Linley. She said to Spencer,
"We'll only need a moment."
"Shall we, then?"
He indicated the door of the church, saying regretfully,
"It's perfectly private inside, if you'd like to talk there. Morning services aren't well attended any longer, nor actually are Sunday services, unless a terrorist attack sends people to church."
They indicated that inside the church was fine with them. So Spencer led the way, taking them to what he called St. John's Chapel. Barbara recognized it from the last time she'd been here, its great stained-glass perpendicular window unforgettable because it had escaped destruction. Spencer spoke first, saying,
"You must be back because of Ian. I'm not sure what I can tell you beyond what I told you at our last encounter."
Linley took up the issue. "Matters turn out to be not quite settled with regard to his death. We'll be prowling round a bit more."
"Are you starting your prowling with me?"
"We did some yesterday."
"Did my name come up?"
"Only in that there are a few questions that weren't asked first time round."
"I see. Well, I'm not sure what help I can be, but I'm completely happy to have a go."
Linley thanked him in that urbane way he had. He nodded at Barbara. She said,
"Last time I was here, Mr. Druitt's dad handed over the deacon's possessions to my gov. We sorted through them, and they all seemed on the up-and-up and logical, if you know what I mean."
"Logically, the belongings of a man of God, I presume."
Spencer pushed his spectacles up the bridge of his nose. They immediately began to slide south again.
"Right," Barbara said. "But me and the inspector here, we're thinking that there might be a few things that got left out, and we wanted to check with you. He lived with you and your wife for a bit, didn't he?"
"For a bit, yes. But I assure you that neither Constance nor I would have kept something belonging to Ian. We would have noticed at once that he'd left it behind. It would have been returned to him. As for our children and grandchildren..."
Barbara hastened to reassure him that they were not there to accuse one of his offspring of kleptomania. She said,
"We're only wondering if you might have seen him with any of the missing items. Actually, we're not sure they're missing at all, because he might not ever have had them in the first place."
"I see. What are these items?"
"A mobile phone, a PC, a tablet, or even a desktop computer."
Spencer nodded and took no time before he replied with,
"When he was with us, he used the computer at the vicarage. It's a bit of a beast. I mean, quite large and rather out of date, but it serves our needs. I'm assuming he picked up his email on it and otherwise used it to contact the various individuals he met with. Of course, I can't speak of what he had at his other lodgings. He might have purchased something when he began to live elsewhere. When he was with Constance and me, though, he had no other device, aside from our computer. At least I never saw anything in his possession."
"Not even a mobile?"
"Oh, sorry, I wasn't including a mobile in that. Yes, indeed, he had a mobile. One of those smarty phones, or whatever they're called."
Barbara cast Linley a bingo look. She said,
"There wasn't a mobile with the lumber we had off his dad. Thora Bevans, that's the woman he had a room from, didn't have one belonging to him either. Can you think where his mobile might be?"
Spencer said as he glanced between Barbara and Linley,
"That's quite odd, isn't it? I can't think why it wasn't amongst his things, unless it simply got left out somehow. Was it perhaps taken into evidence when he died? I ask because he was very good about keeping it with him, so he would have had it that night. There was always someone trying to contact him. He was needed here, then needed there, and he didn't like people to ring and not be able to reach him. I mean, by phoning the vicarage or his lodgings."
They were all silent for a moment, considering this. Linley said reflectively, "As I recall from the paperwork, he was taken from this church, wasn't he? He was doing a service, or dressing for a service, or just finishing a service?" Spencer smiled.
"Of course, the vestry. He would have left it there when he put on his vestments. Force of habit, and he wouldn't have wanted the distraction of it buzzing or going off or whatever during prayers. Do come with me."
Spencer led them out of the chapel and back into the nave. They walked up the middle aisle and into the chancel, where a heavy oak door set deeply into the church's stone interior took them into the vestry. There Spencer flipped on a set of bright overhead lights, which shone down upon closed cupboards as well as a bank of drawers and locked glass-fronted cabinets. These last held the requisite items for a church service, chalices, patens, crosses, and the like. The rest was kept in the cupboards and the drawers.
"Now," Spencer said to them, "it must be here somewhere. I suggest the drawers rather than the cupboards. Those hold cassocks, surplices, and the chasubles. The larger vestments. The cassocks have pockets, but it isn't likely he would have put his mobile into a cassock he intended to wear for the service, is it? Let's check the drawers."
The wider drawers held, Barbara saw, the starched white dressings for the altar. Further down the row of them, seasonal banners appeared to be stored. There was nothing else in any of them, but on either side of these was a row of narrower drawers holding neatly folded stoles, candles, printed histories of the church, postcards to sell, and, as it turned out, a mobile phone and a set of keys.
"Here we are, my friends," Christopher Spence said. "This must be Ian's, because it isn't mine. And these would be his car keys as well."
Of course, Barbara thought. Ian Druitt would have had a bloody car. He wouldn't have taken public transport into town from Flora Bevan's home, and he certainly wouldn't want to rely on public transport to get him to his various commitments. It was one more thing she hadn't thought to bring up with Ardrey, and she was furiously embarrassed about this fact. She looked at Linley to measure the level of his irritation with her and the Gov, but he merely looked thoughtful. He said to Spencer, "Any idea where his car might be?" Spencer pulled at his upper lip before saying,
"It's restricted parking in the immediate area. Residents, deliveries, that sort of thing. Although here and there one can find two-hour spots. I think Ian generally used one of the car parks, because he would have been here longer than 2 hours, you see."
He gave the subject a bit more thought before adding,
"There are two that would have worked for him. One's behind the college, West Mercia College, just off Castle Square, and another is quite near the library. That's on the other side of Corfe Street, up from the Bullring. And it's easy enough to reach the church from there. However—and
here Spencer looked, if anything, deeply apologetic, as he said,
"the trouble is that he would have been towed by now. They wouldn't have used the clamp. They generally don't."
"Might his father have come for it, with an extra set of keys?" Linley asked.
"It's possible, providing he knew where to find it, of course."
"He hasn't asked you about it." Spencer shook his head.
"Only you have."
"Do you know what kind of motor he drove?"
Barbara asked him.
"Oh, Lord, I'm so sorry. I'm wretched at cars. I saw it but didn't think to register what it was, aside from blue. And it was old. That's all I can tell you."
Ludlow, Shropshire. Before they left the vicar, Linley told the man that he and Havers might have to take his desktop computer for a forensic specialist to have a go with. He explained that, since Ian Druitt had use of the computer during the time he lived with the Spencers, he may have left some sort of trail upon it that would assist them in their investigation. Spencer looked concerned when he heard the word trail, but he didn't ask what sort of trail Linley meant, and he assured them that he would be ready to hand over the computer if that was required of him. They went on their way. Their first objective was to find a charger for Druitt's mobile, which was at this point dead. Linley reckoned that the hotel would have a supply of chargers for hapless residents who showed up without theirs, so he and Havers began to retrace their steps in that direction. At this hour, the market stalls were up and running. It appeared to be clothing, bedding, and bric-a-brac day. Linley was surprised to see that the affair caught Barbara's interest, less surprised when she said,
"There's Harry, Inspector,"
and led him not to one of the stalls, but rather to a line of five individuals offering wares from blankets they'd laid out on the cobbles that edged the square's east end. Harry, Linley saw, was a late, middle-aged bloke accompanied by an intimidating Alsatian. The man wore clean but otherwise wrinkled clothes, a pair of trousers that seemed too short for him, and a golf shirt with St. Andrew's embroidered on its left breast. He had Birkenstock sandals on his feet and a droopy straw hat to protect him from the sun. He swept this off when he spied Barbara approaching him, and he got to his feet and made an antique bow. The Alsatian did likewise, minus the bow, plus some considerable tail-wagging. She was apparently called Sweet Pea, Linley heard, and she was friendly as a kitten, according to Havers.
"What are you flogging today?"
Havers asked the man.
"And how long do you expect to sit here before the PCSO runs you off again?"
"How I do try to win over Officer Ruddock," Harry said in a voice that came very close to the real voice,
and was something of a shock to Linley.
"I find it a source of profound sadness to be at such odds with the man. I honestly don't intend it."
"So why'd you do it?"
"One does so hate to see the waste that occurs in modern society."
Linley saw that he was referring to the items he had on offer upon his blanket. These consisted of a pair of tarnished grape scissors, 2 leather dog leads, 4 porcelain cups, without saucers, 2 sandwich plates in very good condition, an ancient slide ruler, a protractor, a compass, and a swatch. There were also 3 cardigans, neatly folded.
"Additionally, of course," Harry went on, "there's the prospect of conversation with people walking by, which I very much enjoy. That doesn't happen whilst one merely sits on the pavement and plays one's flute in front of a shop, you see. I've noticed over time that people tend to avoid someone who appears to sleep rough. I expect it's due to their belief that something might be asked of them and they won't know how to cope. And, of course, sweet pea doesn't help matters. Aside from yourself, Sergeant, no one else has ever approached me when I'm in a doorway. Who is your companion, might I ask?"
"D.R. Linley," she said.
"Also from the Met, like me. Might one inquire what you and D.I. Linley are doing in Ludlow?"
"Just now we're looking for a phone charger. We've managed to come up with Ian Druitt's mobile."
"Have you indeed? Is this something of a coup?"
"We won't know till we charge the phone. You don't have one, do you?"
"A phone, yes. Long ago I caved in to my sister's anxiety about my sleeping habits and other elements of my lifestyle. I have no charger, though, being without the means to use one. My banker charges mine whenever I hand it over to him for an hour or two, however."
Another surprise. One could hardly picture this scarecrow of a man having a banker. He let Havers continue.
"Any interesting business going on round town that you care to share?" she asked him.
"Binge drinking and the like? Riots in the square? Cheesemongers deciding to go on strike?"
Unconsciously, Harry lifted his golf shirt and scratched his fish-flesh stomach. He said,
"They're setting up for the annual Shakespeare Festival on the castle grounds, but I doubt that's what you mean, although someone did break a leg when she fell through the platform's trap door yesterday. Hadn't been fastened properly. Let me see, what else? Ah, 2 days ago we had a tour coach fail in front of the concert hall, and 38 elderly women in twin sets and brogues were left waiting on the curb 3 hours for a replacement. One would think elderly women, having seen so much of life, would have had more patience with the problem. But there was a great deal of walking stick waving, and at least one Zimmer was shaken in a threatening manner. Officer Ruddock had to have a chat with them. If he hadn't done, a blue-haired riot might well have broken out.
Has he had to roust drinkers from round the Hart Nine since I've been gone?"
"Not that I'm aware of. But of course it's possible. Young people being who they are, and the college nearby..."
"He's not popped anyone into the patrol car, then?"
Harry gazed at her, and then at Linley. His eyes, Linley saw, were intelligent and frank. He said,
"I hope the poor lad isn't in trouble. He's quite a decent bloke, even though he won't allow us lot," he gestured to his companion vendors on their blankets, "to do our bit here, but that's on the demand of the mayor and the town council. No one blames him for following their orders."
Linley wasn't sure where Havers was going with this. He wondered if she had a plan for the conversation. It seemed she did, at least in some respect, because after another few words between her and Harry, she told him goodbye, advised him to keep an eye out on the goings-on round Ludlow, and handed him her card so that he could phone her if anything interesting popped into his head. As they headed back towards Griffith Hall, she said to Linley,
"He sees a lot, that bloke. He told me a bit about the PCSO carting drunken college types to wherever, and I'd already seen him, Ruddock this is, doing whatever it was with a young woman inside his patrol car at night. He said he has no girlfriend or partner, Ruddock this is, so he's had me wondering. Like I told the Gov, if he was out in the next car park making surreptitious nasties with some young thing in his car, anyone could have got inside the place to do away with Druitt, and Ruddock would hardly want someone to know that's how it happened."
When they walked into the entry of Griffith Hall, a young man who actually was not peace on earth held up a hand to stop them as he completed a phone call, after which he said, "You've had a message," to Havers, and he handed over a folded piece of foolscap, which the sergeant unfolded and read, saying to Linley,
"The PCSO stopped by. If we need him for anything, we're to ring. He's ready to help."
She looked up from the paper and added,
"I expect you want to meet him, sir."
"I will," Linley told her.
The receptionist then said to them both, "There's a gentleman waiting for you in the residence lounge. I did tell him I wasn't sure when you would return, but he wished to wait." The gentleman turned out to be Clive Druitt. He rose from mid-morning coffee as they joined him, saying, "Are you the Met officers? My MP told me two were on their way." He told them he brought Ian's belongings with him, just in case they wished to go through them another time. The other officer, that woman, as he called her, and Linley could see Havers's hackles rising at the term, had assured him she and a sergeant had gone through everything once, but he had a feeling about that one, he did. Earlier, when he'd met her near Kidderminster, her breath... Well, never mind. She's off the case now. Linley's, not exactly, didn't do much to reassure the older man, but he had no wish to hear anything about Isabel's breath, because he knew quite well where that could lead between him and Havers, and he didn't want to go there. Instead, he thanked Clive Druitt for making the trip, and he asked, as he'd done before, whether his son had possessed a PC, tablet, or desktop computer. "Ian," Clive Druitt said with a short laugh, "not bloody likely. He was hopeless with technology. He did have a desktop computer years ago, but he drove it into the ground when he figured he'd delete a few items that he wasn't using. Ended up deleting the entire operating system. That was it as far as he was concerned." "No email account, Facebook page, LinkedIn or whatever?" Havers asked. "He would have done all that on his mobile, which wasn't amongst his things, by the way. I'd like to know what happened to it." "We have it," Linley told the man. Peace on Earth appeared at this juncture, offering mid-morning coffee, fizzy water, orange juice. "Just someone to carry these boxes up to my room," Linley told the young man.
"Best put them in my room, Inspector," Havers said. "More space if we mean to have another go with them."
"I damn well hope you do," Clive Druitt said. "I hope you mean to have another go with everything. I want nothing swept under the carpet this time." "We aren't certain that happened earlier," Linley replied. Before Druitt could argue the point, Linley told the man he'd like to have the birth dates of every member of the immediate Druitt family, as well as the phone number of each. He explained that there was probably going to be a code to unlock Ian's phone, and, people being people, there was every chance that the deacon had used numbers that came from one of those sources. Druitt asked when he needed those numbers. Linley politely told him now, if he didn't mind. Havers took out her notebook and mechanical pencil, her expression becoming immediately fascinated with whatever Druitt intended to reveal. His revelations included a phone call to his wife, as it seemed he knew only the birth date of their first child, and he was even a bit unsure about that. Fortunately, his wife was not, and he repeated the numbers as she gave them to him so that Havers could make note of them. He listened to his wife for a moment after the recitation was completed, and then he told Havers that Ian had been awfully fond of his great-aunt Uma, and here were the relevant numbers for Aunt Uma as well. Once he'd rung off with his wife, he said sharply, "What are you after with Ian's phone?" to Linley. "It's all procedure. We'll be putting in a request for his phone records as well, but what you've given us might give us a leg up in advance of getting them." "My son was a clean liver," Druitt said. "Anything different you're told about him is a lie." He took up a quite large, padded manila envelope then, and he handed it to Linley. It contained, Linley saw, a billfold, a Bible, the Book of Common Prayer, an address book, and a sheaf of bills that Ian Druitt's father had paid after his death. Havers fashioned a receipt to give him, and when she handed it over, Druitt rose, saying, "If there's nothing else I can do for you—" There was one thing, Linley told him. They were attempting to find Ian's car, but while they had the keys to it, they didn't have the make, model, or year. Could Mr. Druitt help them with that? Did he have the car by any chance? He did not, but he told them how to identify it. It was a Hillman, vintage 1962, light blue in colour, and there was considerable rust on the rear wings round the wheel wells. Period transfers decorated the rear window, celebrating the kinks, mostly, but there were several enthusing over the stones as well. He didn't know the number plates, but there couldn't have been too many vehicles like it in town. And then, taking his own car keys from his pocket, he ended with, "Someone murdered Ian. As I stand in front of you and swear to it, someone murdered my son." Linley said as gently as he could manage, "It's very difficult to fake a suicide by hanging." "Someone," Druitt asserted, "managed to do it." Ludlow, Shropshire. Brutus hadn't even created an excuse. That made it worse. Yes, Ding had been having it off with Finn, and yes, Finn was one of their housemates, but it wasn't as if Finn and Brutus were friends. Ding totally knew that Brutus had selected Francie. Probably he'd even tracked her down, challenging himself with,
Let's see if the dish with the big ones will get it on with me. But the other part was, if this is how you want it, Ding, see how it can be? Which was also pure Brutus. And that was seriously unfair, because he just didn't get it. But not getting it didn't excuse him, because when he brought Francie back to the house, when they could have gone to Francie's home, or to her car, or even to somewhere on the banks of a team, Ding knew that Brutus was sending her a message. Fine and all right, was the conclusion she came to. If that's how Brutus wanted things to be, then that's how things were going to be. But they weren't going to be that way with her friends, no matter what he thought. She wanted to have a word with Francie. She knew it would be easy enough, since between spontaneous rounds of bonking anything with the right equipment when the mood was upon her, Francie was a creature of habit. So once Ding had cooled off sufficiently to put behind her the sight of Francie on her knees at Brutus's crotch, Ding knew where to find her, at the life drawing class. This was tucked at the back of the Palmer's Hall campus in Mill Street, one of the three areas in town where classrooms and lecture halls were located. Here the art studios shared space with the photography classrooms and digital printing labs, along with the areas set aside for media studies. The bottom half of the windows for life drawing were papered, as was the window in the door. This was, Ding knew, to afford models a modicum of privacy from anyone wishing to peer inside. When Ding opened the door, the instructor approached her, hands held palm upward in a universal halt gesture. Ding said to the rather imposing woman, who wore a medical lab coat splodged with paint and smudged with charcoal, that she needed to have a word with Francie Adamucci. The instructor said, "She's occupied. You'll have to wait for a break. And do your waiting outside, please. This is a private class." "She won't mind. It's important." "I'll mind." "It's fine with me, Miss Maxwell," Francie called out from the dais upon which she stood in three-quarters profile, absolutely naked, a wreath on her head and a shallow basket of fruit balanced against one hip. "I know her. It's fine with me if she wants to stay." She neither moved her head nor altered her pose as she spoke, as if with the wish of demonstrating that Ding's intrusion into her session of nude modelling would not affect her. Miss Maxwell said, "As long as she doesn't distract you." "She won't," Francie said. "Will you, Ding?" Ding assured the instructor that she would be brief and be gone, and she was given leave to approach the model. She realized, when she reached Francie, however, that this might not be the best of times, since she wanted to be eyeball to eyeball with her friend, and that wouldn't happen while Francie was modelling. Plus, seeing Francie naked was disheartening. She was voluptuous, a complete contrast to Ding, who had all the right parts, just not like these. Unlike a lot of modern girls, Francie didn't strip herself of her pubes. Her bush was trimmed neatly to the shape of a shield, but there was none of the excessive waxing that turned young women into little girls, underwear models or porn stars. Instead, Francie announced that if some bloke didn't like the look of a real woman, then to hell with him. She wasn't about to do things to her body in order to appeal to some juvenile's wet dream fantasy. She did draw the line at body hair elsewhere, however. Hairy armpits and hairy legs, even hairy toes, hairs on the nipples, she wouldn't have that. There was being a real woman, and there was being a real woman, she would say. Whatever that meant. Ding got as close to the dais as she could. She said in a quiet tone, "I just want to know if it was him or you." Francie didn't pretend to misunderstand.
"The idea, do you mean?"
"We'll start with whose idea it was, and we'll go from there."
"It didn't mean anything," Francie said. "Brutus is a cutie, but it's not like... I mean, I don't want him, Ding. He's... what? Is he even 18 years old? What would I want with an 18-year-old?
"You're not saying, though, are you?" Ding hissed.
"Huh? What am I not saying?"
"Whose idea it was. That's what I want to know first."
"Idea?
All right, let me think." Francie's brow furrowed for a moment as she thought about what had occurred in Brutus's room, or at least she pretended to think about it. She finally said,
"It's that... I'm not sure."
"Oh, that's rich, that is. I'm expected to believe that."
"Well, you know me, don't you?"
When Ding made no reply to this, Francie sighed and said,
"All right, I'll try."
And then after a moment of putative trying,
"He was on the river kayaking."
"Alone?"
"He had some random girl with him. No clue who she was." "What did she look like?"
"I don't know. It's not like I studied them or anything. Maybe she was sort of round in the shoulders. Oh, yes, I do remember she had a terrible haircut. She was wearing a tank top. I remember that as well. And truly hideous running shorts from what I could see of them when she got out of the kayak. Baggy in the arse. And the colour? Appalling. Like mushy peas gone bad."
Ding rolled her eyes. Trust Francie to note the girl's haircut and her wearing apparel.
"Get on with it, then," she told her. I was on Ladford Bridge. I was crossing over from home, and I heard someone call out my name, and there they were, Brutus and Bagios. She had on those specs that change colours in the sun. And, oh yeah, she was wearing this necklacey thing, something super large, like it was an Olympic medal or something.
Alison Franklin, Ding said. The description was